Thank you, Marianne. I really appreciate that introduction. And thank you all for including me today and giving me this space to talk. Thank you, Marianne, for inviting me and thinking of me and encouraging me to speak in this group. I have to admit, I was a little reluctant at first, being a white person asked to speak in a seminar about confronting racism. I, you know, immediately felt like maybe my voice shouldn't be included. I was happy to see the amount of people of color who have been speaking in this, and I've been listening to the presentations as they've been posted on the website. And I told Marianne that there would be a condition if I do speak, and that condition is that I will only speak to the white people in the group. And as I'm looking at the three pages of faces on this virtual meeting, I see a sea of white people. So I'm speaking to a lot of folks, and I'll get more into this with my presentation, but I really feel that my call as a white person who is trying to be as committed as possible to the work of anti-racism is to speak to white people and to speak to the system of white supremacy, and to do anything I can to make sure that there are diverse voices present, especially as those voices speak to the actual experience of racism. And so I'm glad that you all have done that with the inclusion of those voices for various groups, various identities. What I'd like to do today more is to focus on my story. As Marianne said, I'm a pastor of a small community that leans right. I think 51% voted Trump in 2016, 49 voted Hillary. I haven't looked at the exit polls for 2020. We come off as a very conservative valley, but we're actually quite center of the road when one looks at the exit polls. And so being the pastor of a small community that leans right, especially the pastor of a historic church that has some notoriety in this valley, I want to speak about my story of being the pastor in this valley and speaking up and doing the work that I can do in anti-racism. And I want to make sure that you all understand that I'm speaking from some very specific identities. And those identities for myself are that I am a white, male, cishet, American Christian pastor who is trying to be committed to the work of anti-racism. And my hope for this presentation is that anyone else in this group who is either white, cisgender, heterosexual, a Christian, a pastor, or a combination of any of these, that my story can help you engage in this work of anti-racism and inclusion even more. So again, thank you all for having me here today. I want to start with my background because I think that's important to my story and the work that I do. As Marianne said, I grew up in the suburbs of Los Angeles. I was born and raised a liberal, and I don't say that in a complimentary way. Growing up, I was always the minority race amongst my friends. I grew up mostly with Latinx and African-American friends, and being a quote-unquote liberal, most of the time aware of my privilege, even being the minority race in this group. I grew up with a father whose grandfather was a Quaker elder, and who his grandparents on his father's side, being Quakers, marched with Dr. King in Selma. And I grew up hearing this story. My father was born in a conscientious objectors camp in Portland, Oregon, because his father refused to be drafted into World War II as long as the United States government was placing Japanese Americans in internment camps. And I grew up hearing the story. That same grandfather of mine would go on to co-found the first interracial housing unit for students at UCLA. And he had to do this in conjunction with students of color off of campus in private housing because UCLA at the time would not endorse interracial housing. And I grew up hearing this story. This same grandfather would go on to run for Congress and win in 1962 and be a congressman for the county of San Bernardino for the next 35 years as part of the Democratic Party. He would go on to champion farm workers' rights, working alongside of Cesar Chavez. He was one of six Congress people to vote against funding for the Vietnam War, and he was one of six, I'm sorry, he was the only congressperson to vote against that funding, and he was one of six congresspeople as a Democrat to vote against the Defense of Marriage Act when it was presented by Bill Clinton. And I grew up hearing all of these stories. And as I grew up hearing these stories, mind you, my father and mother, also lifelong Democrats, were virtually uninvolved in causes of anti-racism and causes of social justice. We were the type of people who could champion these things, who could tell the stories of my grandfather and my great-grandparents while simultaneously doing very little and getting involved in very little as well. What this resulted in was me as a white liberal growing up with a very conflated image of myself, always willing to champion things, always willing to say that I support these things, but ultimately doing very little in the work of anti-racism, of inclusion, of social justice. However, it was enough that I felt called to ministry, and so I went to seminary in Southside, Chicago, at the Lutheran School of Theology of Chicago. We were right next door to the University of Chicago, which finds itself in Hyde Park. I went to seminary four blocks away from President Obama's house in the neighborhood that he spent quite a bit of time in, a neighborhood that he famously took Michelle Obama on their first date to. When I got to Chicago, I was introduced to a whole new world of racism. LSTC is in Hyde Park, and because it's in Hyde Park where the University of Chicago is, Hyde Park is the third most patrolled area by police in the entire country. That's because Hyde Park has its own police department and the University of Chicago has its own police department. The gentrification that happened in Hyde Park in the 40s and 50s pushed the areas where blues were first created to the outskirts of Hyde Park because white students who were going to the University of Chicago didn't want any black members of the community around them. So being at a seminary committed to anti-racism in this part of Chicago, I was introduced to some very serious gentrification, redlining, food deserts, white flight, brutal policing, tremendous gun violence, and on and on and on. My seminary, I would say, was somewhat dedicated to the work of anti-racism. At the very least, they made sure that there were classes and coursework that we could be involved in that helped us understand the system of racism in Chicago. And kind of our call as pastors to address that. One of the classes that I had the privilege of taking was a class called Confronting the Powers and Principalities of Racism. It was a class that was led by a guest professor whose name is Reverend Dr. Yvonne Delk. She is a woman who absolutely walks the walk. She was very active in the civil rights movement as a young woman. She is the first African-American to be ordained in the United Church of Christ. And just a powerhouse of a person to be present with for this course. This course, Confronting the Powers and Principalities of Racism, was structured to look at racism and the structures of racism in Chicago specifically. And she had it arranged so that we were able to go. We spent very little time in the classroom, spent most of our time going around and meeting with figures within Chicago. We met people that were running organizations and programs that were addressing gun violence in Chicago, food scarcity in Chicago, the lack of resources for African Americans and Latinx populations, and trying to get folks job training, resume building, interview training. We were able to go and speak with powerhouse speakers such as Reverend Jeremiah Wright, Reverend Otis Moss III, and Father Flager, who have been committed to this work in the Chicago area for decades. And it was a really meaningful experience as a white person to go through each of these and to actually see the monster of systemic racism. I mean, it had a very profound effect on me as a white person. When the class ended, we all had one specific question that we had to answer as students. And mind you, this was a class that had two African-American students, the rest of us were white. And this question that she asked us to answer at the very end was, after everything we had been through in this course, what are we as seminary students called to now? And as students went up and answered these questions, they said things like engage with locally with leaders and organizations to address systemic racism, to confront my own racism. And these were very practical answers to these questions. When my turn came up, I just felt like I was being filled up with passion. And I couldn't wait to share my answer with the class. And so when I got up there and this question was posed, what are you called to? My response was, I feel called to save the world. And I stood back and waited for people to nod or give me that, ah, or to even clap maybe. And what I was greeted with instead was complete silence and dumbfounded looks. Almost pity, mind you. It wasn't until years later that I realized I was raised to believe this about myself. I was raised to think that as a white person, my job was to save the world. And I had realized that I wasn't really chasing the work of what this might entail, but more I was chasing the acknowledgement, the recognition, the good feeling that comes with that. I was chasing that nodding approval from my classmates. And I finally understood why I didn't receive that. Because I, as a white person, was raised to believe that I am the hero of the story. Now, to make this point a little bit more viscerally, I asked Tim if he could play a trailer for all of us. I don't know how many of you remember this movie. It is the trailer for the movie called Power of One, starring Stephen Dorff and Morgan Freeman. It came out in 1992. It's based on a book. I'll say more about the movie after Tim plays the trailer for all of us.
From the Academy Award-winning director of Rocky and the Karate Kid comes the story of a boy orphaned in a land he loved.
I am Phil Pete.
I'm PK.
In harmony with the people that were not his family.
Hey, we have a boxer here.
As he grew, he trained to protect what he treasured.
It's Big Zulu.
Yeah, boy.
Learned to defend what he valued.
If we let them get away with it on our own grounds, it will never change.
He fought with his fists.
I want you to start the school to teach my people to read and write English.
How much difference will that really make?
But he led with his heart.
A waterfall begins with only one drop of water, sir.
And found that one person can make a difference through the power of one. Stephen Dorff, John Gielgud, and Morgan Freeman. This unparalleled motion picture will take you on a breathtaking adventure into a remarkable triumph of the heart. Discover its uplifting power, the power of one.
Thank you, Tim. Without feeling the need to answer these out loud, I just want you to answer these questions in your head real quick. And they're very much rhetorical questions, but you have the trailer of this movie, which when I asked how many of you remember this, a lot of you nodded your heads, a powerful film that came out in the 90s. Who is the hero of that story? Who is the main character of that story? You have this African music playing in the background. You have the voices of African people singing. But very much the hero of that story is the white person. The Power of One is the story of a white boy who grows up into a white man in apartheid South Africa. It very much includes the story of what African people were going through in apartheid South Africa, the pain that they were experiencing, the racism that they were going through. But the entire time, the center of this story is this character, PK, this white boy. In fact, in the story, he's even given a title. It's called The Rainmaker. The character that is portrayed by Morgan Freeman tells him that there is a prophecy that there will be someone who will come and unite the African tribes in South Africa to finally fight against racism, against apartheid South Africa. And that character, that rainmaker, the one that this prophecy is talking about is a white person. When I grew up watching The Power of One, there was something about the movie that I just absolutely loved. But as I got older, I realized that this is wrong. This is the story of racism and the fight against racism, but how a white person is the one who has to come and save everybody. You see, white supremacy is so magnanimous and ingrained in our society that we as white liberals or white people who are committed to the work of anti-racism, whatever title you want to give it, we are raised to think that we are the heroes of the story. We are the saviors. And because we are raised that way, we are perpetually chasing the good feelings that come with the work of anti-racism and being perpetually ignorant of the actual experiences of Black and Indigenous folks, of people of color, and the very real struggles and deep risk that is entailed with anti-racism work. I mean, just think of some of the most pivotal movies that we have in Hollywood over the last decade or two decades that have dealt with the work of anti-racism. I compiled a quick list off the top of my head. I came up with Green Book, The Help, Blindside, Dances with Wolves, The Green Mile, Freedom Riders, A Time to Kill. Movies that often stand out in the minds of people when they think of films that have captured how ugly racism can be. But what these movies all have in common is that they either portray the helpless Black person or the helpless Indigenous group or the helpless group of people of color until the white savior shows up and finally rescues them or saves them or offers them what they need to have their liberation. See, we have been taught as white people, and I very much include myself in this, to see ourselves as the hero of the story and to chase that good feeling. And what ends up happening is we realize that this is very superficial work when it comes to the work of anti-racism. And ultimately, the system goes unchanged. This is why after George Floyd's death, we saw Black squares fill profile pictures on social media. We saw BLM hashtags en masse. We saw other solidarity posts dealing with racism and calling it out. And almost all of these are gone now. The Black squares, the hashtags, the posts of solidarity, they're gone. Because this topic is no longer trending, because this topic is no longer popular. This is why we saw major businesses spend an insane amount of money on publicity in favor of anti-racism, but doing very little to change their structure. It's why the NFL, after George Floyd's death, spent millions of dollars on anti-racism publicity, but yet has to issue any kind of an apology to Colin Kaepernick or to address what happened with him no longer being involved in the NFL. This is why board of directors in 2020, despite spending millions of dollars on publicity for anti-racism work, have had virtually no movement in increasing diversity within their boards of directors. And that information comes from the Institutional Shareholder Services. And they were only able to capture a glimmer of what boards were able to do because most boards were not willing to report any work that they've done to increase diversity. This is why white people run for and are elected en masse to so many positions in politics, from municipal to national politics. This is why so many white people will come out and include within their platforms the work of anti-racism, but refuse to step down when people of color, people of minority groups come forward also wanting to run for these same positions. We love to chase power as white people. We love authority. We love the good feelings that come with the work of anti-racism. We love to be included in the stuff that is trending, the stuff that's popular, the stuff that helps us in our respective organizations create brands for ourselves. It's why we spend so much time learning about racism gathering and talking about racism and do very little to actually address racism as white people. I had a very pivotal moment for me where this finally came to a head. In my denominational body of Lutheran, we are called the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America. We are the largest branch of Lutherans in the country. We also have the most progressive theology of most mainline Protestant denominations, and definitely of all the Lutherans. We are also the second whitest church in the entire country, despite our progressive theology. A few years ago, a colleague of mine, a Black queer man by the name of Lenny Duncan, wrote a book addressed to our denominational body called Dear Church. And I would highly recommend that anyone get it, especially anyone who is involved in the work of anti-racism within a church structure, within a faith body, especially a Christian one. I would very much recommend going out and getting Lenny's book called Dear Church. You can apply his personal story, his emotion, and his love for the church, I imagine, to any of our church bodies. Essentially, it was a book that Lenny wrote. He called it a love letter to the ELCA. It was a love letter in the sense that he loved the church because of the liberating message that he got from his original church body, which accepted him as a Black queer person. But it was also a book that entailed a tremendous amount of anger, because as he decided to become an ordained pastor within this church body, as he was introduced into the larger bureaucratic structure of the ELCA, he saw the same amount of racism and queer phobia that he encountered in the other facets of his life. And this book was about calling the church to be better. A group of us in my geographical area decided to get together and do a meeting after reading this book, kind of a one-time book group on this. And this book had a powerful impact on all of us. And we were a group, I'd say, that was evenly split. Half of us were white, the other half were people of color, some Black, some Latinx, some also intersecting with queerness, various gender expressions. And we had this moment where we all sat down to talk about this book, the impact it had on us, and what we wanted to do in the way of addressing racism in our geographical area. And the first question that was posed to everybody in the group was, how did this book impact you? How did this book make you feel about doing the work of anti-racism in our area? And the first person to raise their hand was a white person. And when they spoke up, they said, I'm excited. I'm excited to do this work. This book has made me passionate. Then another person raised their hand who also was white and basically said the same thing. I can't wait to get more involved in this. I can't wait to do more. I can't wait to be better. And then another white person echoed that. And then another white person echoed that. Think about four or five white people spoke up first before a Latinx woman finally raised her hand and spoke up. And as she began to speak, I could see her bottom lip trembling and her voice starting to croak. And she said, I'm scared. I'm scared to trust all of you. I'm scared to trust all of you white people because I've been hurt so badly in the past by white people saying that they're going to do something and then failing in that promise. Then a Black woman raised her hand and she said, I'm tired. I'm tired of having to always do this work alone. I'm tired of having to fight for my survival. I'm just simply tired. As these answers went on, it was very quickly apparent that every person of color in this group had a very different reaction to this book than every white person. Every white person came with this excitement at starting this work. And every person of color came with exhaustion and tiredness and fear because they've been doing this work for so long, because they felt that they had been betrayed by white colleagues who are constantly chasing that good feeling, constantly saying that they are so excited to do the work. And then when that good feeling dissipates, they disappear. The last question that was posed was, are you still committed to this after our discussion? And I think all of the eyes were on the folks of color because of the fear and trepidation that they had expressed in this. And there was one person who spoke up that I will forever remember, and this had the biggest impact on me. It was that same girl that initially spoke up crying, and she said, yes, because I have to, because I'm doing this for my survival and I have no other choice. That was an absolute turning point for me as a white male cishet pastor to see the differences in our reactions to this book and to realize that that disparity existed for a reason. Because the impacts of racism in this world do not affect me as a white person the way they affect my colleagues of color. I have never once had to feel like I was fighting for my own survival. And I have always, always had the option to step away from the work of anti-racism. My work against racism throughout my life, which has been extremely limited and in the last few years has been a lot better, has been almost entirely enshrouded in my experience as a white person. And the same goes for gender equality and for LGBTQ plus equality. It has been entirely enshrouded in my experience as a white cishet male. And that's why I can go most of my life hearing about what my white grandparents did and my white great-grandparents did and hearing very little about the folks that they were trying to support. It's why I can grow up in the minority race of my friend group, even though I'm aware of my privilege and realizing that I knew very little of my friends' experiences with racism. My entire life, I never really understood their experiences as people of color. It's why I can spend most of my life being in support of anti-racism and realizing that when I look back, I've done very little to actually address it. So I would say my journey in the work of anti-racism really has only started, I don't know, maybe 6-7 years ago. And what I'd like to share now is what I've committed to doing in my area. And this is not a comprehensive list by any stretch of the imagination. This is what is available for me and my context and my circumstances. I don't think we have the time to do a comprehensive list. Also, there's so much books out there and material for us as white people to go and read and to understand this for ourselves. But the truth is, as a white person, I'm still very much failing at this work. I'm still learning and I'm still growing. But I think what needs to be important is that I'm still committed and engaged in the work itself. So this is what I've committed to, and I've got 4 points here. The first one is that as a pastor in a small community, especially since George Floyd's death, but many times before this, I've either hosted rallies or I've been asked to speak at rallies or protests here in our valley. And what I've committed to is that at any time that happens, I as a white person need to make sure that there is representation from Black folks, from Indigenous folks, from people of color, from LGBTQ plus folks. I absolutely need to make sure that that is present and that it is central, especially to what that protest or what that rally is about. I need to be aware that in those moments when I'm asked to speak, and it happened when Marianne asked me to speak for this group, that the ego comes up, that there's this element of excitement, of being acknowledged, being able to speak in front of people. And I'm a pastor, I love to speak in front of people. And so I need to be able to check myself and make sure that I'm doing right and either stepping aside or making sure that my voice is coming from the side and that there's representation from Black folks, Indigenous folks, people of color, and LGBTQ plus folks. I've decided that when I do speak, as I said at the beginning of this meeting, I'm going to try my hardest to speak to the people whose identities I represent. And for all of us, that's for all the white people, for all the cisgendered people, for all the heterosexual people, for all the clergy, for the Americans, especially the white Americans. What I try to do is to speak to our privilege in these identities, to speak to how we miss the mark with racism so often. We miss the mark with white supremacy. We miss the mark with white privilege, and that this system has been built around us in such a way that we aren't even aware of it. and we need to be, to speak to our shortcomings and our failures, especially when it comes to protecting our own levels of comfort and avoiding risk with anti-racism work, and how we can do better. One of the things that I've tried to do, and I think this is important for all of us, this is my second point, is to ask myself, where do I have power and influence because of my position and my identities? And then use that in the work of anti-racism. Because it's a small community, because we are all aware of each other in this community, and because I'm a pastor of a historic church, the first church that was started in Solvang, my voice and my title as pastor carries some weight and some influence, and I need to use that where I can. I need to use that to go to local school board meetings, city council meetings, rallies, different civic organizations, and call out racist policies and procedures. And this does become very important in municipal and local settings, because racism is often overlooked in these small local and municipal locations by white people. Because racism doesn't affect our lives directly as white people, even though we're committed to the work, we are often looking at the bigger picture of anti-racism, and we overlook how racism and systemic issues are present even in our little corners of the world. Here at my church, I have been committed to diversity training, anti-racism training, and education for my congregation to help us learn about our white privilege, about white supremacy, about how it's present very much in the church, why Cornel West calls white churches slaveholder Christianity, and why that rings true today. I am responsible for the members of this church and for our theology and our philosophy. And so I have to make sure that I'm helping all of us learn and grow together and be involved in these issues in our community. I need to make sure that the boards that I have at my church, my council, my committees, are as representative as possible of the diversity in our community. I need to be able to step out of my comfort in this small town and be public about this. And when the backlash comes at me, which it very much does, stick with it. Because I'll tell you that temptation to step back into my comfort is always there for me as a pastor. And I need to use my platform as a pastor to invite Black and Indigenous folks, people of color, and LGBTQ plus folks to come and speak at my church. I'm not sure if my church would call a Black pastor or an Indigenous pastor or a pastor of color or a pastor who is LGBTQ plus, but I do have this platform here with my church, and I can invite anybody I want to come and speak, to preach, to share the word of God, to bless us, and I need to be able to do that. I had a group here at my church that that I was leading. We were talking about racism, and I don't know if I've seen a couple other clergy in this group. I don't know if you've had this experience as well. And this is often what happens with pastors, is the assumption is that we're the ones who are going to do all the work in our churches. And so as we were having this conversation about anti-racism, the group started asking me, so what are you going to do, Pastor? What are you going to do to help Bethania? And my response is, what are you going to do? Now, I imagine the vast majority of you in this group today are members of a church community or a faith community. I can't begin to describe how much power you have within your churches. And so what I did with this group when I was meeting with them is to say, look, if I'm the one saying this stuff by myself all the time, it's going to become easier and easier for people to either ignore me, disregard me, or say, there goes pastor again. But if you as congregants, as members of the church, come together and start doing this work and start speaking out as well, people will realize that this is something that is embodied in our church, in our theology, and it's not just the power, or it's not just the pastor who is speaking. And one of the best things you can do for any of your faith leaders is to make sure that you are speaking alongside them or engaging in this work with them, or by God, even taking on the work yourself. Because there is a tremendous amount of risk for clergy, especially white clergy, to step out and do this work. And you all can help so much by making sure you aren't just listening and learning and complimenting the pastor on their sermons or their speeches or whatever, but make sure that you are stepping up and talking and working and engaging alongside them. And I've been working with my congregation to encourage them to start doing that too. And then point number three, and this is a big one, I'm starting to get a little bit more recognition for some of the anti-racism work that I've been doing. And that makes me uncomfortable because I don't think I deserve it. However, I think the reason I'm starting to get some recognition is because of how I've been engaged in my small community of the San Ynez Valley. When it comes to the big work of anti-racism, I feel like I fall short so badly. And I've told myself, you know what, I can't really do much in that area anyways, but what I can do is the best that I can here in my little bubble of a valley, of the San Ynez Valley. And so my third point that I've committed to is to be tangible. I can't solve racism. I wish I could with the snap of my finger. I wish I could do more for the big picture of it because I feel so called to this work. But I can do stuff in my community now. And so I have to ask myself constantly, where can I affect change today? What I've done over the last year or so is to collaborate with people and focus on the boards and the civic organizations in this community, school boards, councils, places of businesses, places that I have influence in because of my position. And not to really just talk about anti-racism or white supremacy, but to actually elect and appoint people to positions of power and to be present and call out these boards and these civic organizations that don't represent the diversity of our community. So a bunch of us in our valley, and we've done this as a valley effort, have gotten together and we got our local, we only have one high school in our valley. So we got our high school to commit itself to being a sanctuary site for undocumented kids who are in school. We did the same with our elementary school. Folks came forward who were from the Latinx community who wanted to run for the high school board for our city council. We immediately got behind them and did everything we can to campaign and to get them elected. And that's what happened. We have an incredible person who's now a member of our high school board. Our mayor of Solvang is a Latinx person. The mayor pro tem is a Latinx woman. When forums were being organized with candidates who are running for these positions, for the first time in the 6 years that I've been here in the San Ynez Valley, questions of how candidates are going to advocate specifically for anti-racism and to help out students of color and LGBTQ students and Indigenous students. First time that these questions were brought up, and we made every single candidate answer those questions. And I'm happy to say we've got candidates elected to these positions in every single one that we went after. And a lot of that was because no one ever thought to do this before. No one ever thought to make anti-racism a central part of running for school board or running for city council in our small little corner of the world. And honestly, it wasn't difficult work. It was something we were able to do immediately simply because folks hadn't thought to do it yet. Because we're so used to letting the system just be the way it is. And then my fourth and final point is, and this is the hardest one I would say, is to commit to learning and growing and trying again after we fail. Because every single one of us is going to fail at this work. We're going to drift back into racism, into white supremacy, because again, it's so ingrained in our societies that we honestly can't help it. And in those moments, when we are called out, and I've been lucky enough to have been called out in a loving and gracious way by colleagues of color and by friends of color, but frankly, they don't owe that to me. And if you are called out in an aggressive way or in an angry way, you need to commit to learning and growing and not retreating back into your comfort and continuing the work and trying again. Because the sad truth is none of us has to do any of this. None of us has to be engaged in the work of anti-racism. This system has been built around us, and we can duck out anytime we want to. And we can just go back to posting hashtags and black squares on social media or do the next thing that's trending. But I really want you all to remember, and maybe you've heard this before, maybe I'm just repeating stuff you already know, that our Black and Indigenous siblings, our siblings of color, our LGBTQ plus siblings, they don't have this choice to just duck out. They don't have this choice to just retreat back into their comfort. They're literally fighting for their survival, and we need to be there with them. So thank you again for letting me present today. I do want to share my question for our breakout, because I've got a little bit to go with it. My question ultimately is, what is your place in anti-racism work? But I don't want you to just simply answer that question. What I want you to do is first consider the identities that you represent. Consider the identities you might have as a white person, as a cisgender person, as a heterosexual person, as an American, as a Christian, as clergy, as a woman, as a man, as a non-gender conforming person. Consider your identities. And I also want you to consider your influence. Where do you have power? What boards are you responsible for? What civic organizations are you in? What places do you have power? And how can you do this work? So I want you to consider all of that when you think of this question. What is your specific place in the work of anti-racism? And I also want to say that if your answer is, I don't know, that's a good answer. I don't know is a good answer. I don't know means that you have a lot of research to do, and that's a good thing. So it's okay if you say, I don't know. But I'd really like you to consider this question from those places, and then I hope you have engaging discussions. So thank you, everybody.